It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
a tenant can ask for a modification or an accommodation at any time, before they're agreeing to rent, after they become renters, and even if they've received an eviction notice and they know that an accommodation would help them not be evicted. And they can do that orally. As an attorney, I always recommend that people do it in writing. The landlord may have a form that they'd prefer that they'd use. That's certainly a good way to do it, because that way you know that you're giving the landlord the information that he needs. And responsibility falls on the individual with a disability who needs the modification or accommodation to request that. It's not up to the landlord to figure out what the individual needs. The individual is the expert on what they need.
Dana Trainum, staff attorney at the Disability Law Center, describes the laws that protect people with disabilities against discrimination in housing and explains both the federal and Virginia Fair Housing Acts. And during this week's News You Can Use, we reveal the true cost of Virginia's historic rehabilitation tax credit. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show was supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 293, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Virginia's historic rehabilitation tax credit is costing taxpayers twice as much as initially thought, according to a recent report to the Joint Subcommittee to Evaluate Tax Preferences. This news, a surprise to many people in the room during the committee hearing that day, bolsters the case for improved oversight of Virginia's costly and largely hidden spending through the tax system. It also shines a light on a complicated oversight arrangement by the state that obscured the full cost of this and other tax credits that are in the same boat. The historic rehab credit is equal to 25% of qualified rehabilitation expenses and is intended to encourage restoration of certified historic properties in Virginia and, in turn, spur economic growth. A study in 2012 concluded that the credit appears to effectively encourage historic rehabilitation. Previous estimates of the historic rehab's credit's annual cost by the Department of Taxation ranged from $23.5 million to $59 million for fiscal years 2011 through 2014. But those estimates only included the credits claimed against Virginia's individual and corporate income taxes. The credit, however, can also be applied to two other taxes, the bank franchise and the insurance premiums license taxes. Until 2013, the State Corporation Commission's Bureau of Insurance administered and collected the insurance premiums license tax. At that time, the Department of Taxation began to administer and collect the insurance premiums license tax, giving them full access to the data on just how costly the historic rehab credit really is. Once the credit applied to all four taxes were tallied, the cost more than doubled to $98 million in state fiscal year 2015, up from $44 million when just counting the impact on the two income taxes. The Historic Rehab Credit is the state's second largest credit in terms of total reduction in taxpayer liability, in part because it can be claimed through multiple taxes rather than just income taxes. While the Historic Rehab Credit was discussed at the Joint Subcommittee meeting, the other seven credits that also can be applied to the bank and insurance premium taxes were not. None of these other seven credits saw a year-over-year increase even remotely close to the $71 million jump in the Historic Rehab Credit, but these credits continue to represent a substantial cost risk for the state. Ongoing oversight of tax expenditures remains critically important because the revenue spent in this manner reduces the amount the state has to invest in making our communities safe, healthy, and productive. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Disability Law Center of Virginia, and we're speaking with Senior Staff Attorney Dana Tranum. We will be talking today about discrimination against persons with disabilities in the area of housing. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Thank you, Marty.
And we'll be talking today about housing discrimination against persons with disabilities. So for the purposes of our discussion, what exactly is considered a disability?
Well, fortunately, in the disability laws, disability is defined pretty much the same across all those different laws that we have for people with disabilities. And that definition is anyone who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. And those include anything from breathing, walking, talking, hearing, working, any of those major life activities that we have.
So what type of housing is covered by fair housing laws that prohibit discrimination against persons with disabilities?
Fair housing covers private residents as well as public. It covers almost all of our housing. There are a few exceptions that aren't covered by the Fair Housing Act, but they're very small. Most housing is covered by the Fair Housing Act. Discrimination against people with disabilities or other protected classes is not allowed.
Now, what specific practices are prohibited by fair housing laws?
Speaking specifically with people with disabilities, it would be not renting to people with disabilities, would not be allowed, having different qualifications for people with disabilities, charging more rent for people with disabilities, basically treating people with disabilities any differently than any other applicant for that housing.
And what about other housing practices like selling or advertising or things of that nature? Is that also covered by the fair housing laws?
It is. It covers everything: sales, leasing, renting, financing. So banking institutions have to follow the Fair Housing Act. Insuring it is also covered. So insurance companies have to follow the Fair Housing Act. None of those organizations can discriminate against people with disabilities.
Now, there are several specific requirements in fair housing laws that I wanted to talk about them one by one. And the first of those would be accessibility requirements. Can you tell us what are the accessibility requirements?
The accessibility requirements cover houses, multifamily houses. So we're talking about buildings that have four or more units. And anything that was built after March of 1991 must have seven things in their housing. They must have an accessible entrance on an accessible route. They must be accessible to public and common areas. Usable doors, that means a door that is not too difficult to open. Accessible route into and through the dwelling unit. Accessible light switches, electrical outlets, reinforced walls in the bathrooms. That would be for grab bars if someone needs them. Usable kitchens and bathrooms. Now, if a building with four or more units has an elevator, they have to have a unit on any floor that meets these requirements. If the building does not have an elevator and there's more than one floor, then it has to be a first floor apartment that has these accessible features.
So that covers multifamily that has four or more units if it's built after
1991.
What about the house? What about the multifamily housing with four or more units that's built before 1991? Do they have any accessibility requirements at all?
That would fall under allowing the individual to create a modification, a reasonable modification. And that also comes into play in smaller units that don't have four, that aren't covered by the accessibility requirements that I just listed. A landlord, or if we're talking about a homeowners association, anybody making that decision has to allow an individual to make those reasonable modifications to the unit.
And can you tell us in more detail what is considered a reasonable modification?
A reasonable modification is a structural change to the unit, to the housing unit, that allows the person with a disability to use that unit. So some examples would be to build a ramp to make stairways accessible. A lot of times you'll see that in an entrance to a housing unit. Some housing units, the doorways are too narrow for wheelchairs, so the doorway may have to be widened. Putting grab bars in bathrooms. For the hearing impaired, they may need to put in visual smoke detectors. Those sort of things. Those are modifications.
And who pays for this type of modification that you're talking about?
Well, the lawyer answer to that is it depends. And what it depends on is what type of housing it is. If it's private housing that receives no federal assistance, then the renter or the person with a disability pays for it. If it's federal housing, then that falls under a different act, the Rehabilitation Act, and the landlord would actually pay for that modification.
Now, you mentioned public housing. Does that cover just conventional public housing, or does that cover any type of federally subsidized housing?
Any type of housing that receives federal assistance is considered public for this purpose.
So since the landlord has to pay if it's federally subsidized housing, I mean, is there any limitation on what is considered reasonable in terms of cost or expense to the landlord?
If it's considered an undue financial burden to do so, and that standard is pretty high because you're looking at an undue burden of, the entire system of the public housing. So if you're looking at, say, Richmond's public housing, you'd be looking at all of Richmond's public housing, and you're looking at an undue financial burden for that system. That's a pretty high standard to meet.
So would it be fair to say that if you've got a federally subsidized landlord, whether it is Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority or some Section 8 apartment complex, that sort of the larger the landlord, the more extreme the financial burden would have to be for a modification to be considered unreasonable and unduly burdensome?
Yes, I think that's a good general statement.
So in a situation where a tenant is requesting a reasonable modification, is there any requirement that the tenant verify the disability before the landlord has the burden of doing the modification?
My favorite answer, it depends. If the individual has a visual disability, and there's no question if the person's in a wheelchair using a walker, you know, it is a visual disability and there's no question about it, then the person doesn't have to provide any sort of verification that they have a disability. If it's an invisible disability and there's some question about it, they are required to provide enough documentation that verifies that they, in fact, have a disability. For some folks, that could mean just showing that they get Social Security disability, supplemental security income. It could be a simple letter from a doctor, case manager. The other part of verification is that they have to show that the disability relates to the modification or accommodation that they're requesting. And so, again, sometimes that's obvious. If a person in a wheelchair needs a ramp, that's obvious. If it's not so obvious, then, you know, that letter from a doctor or a case manager may need to say they need this because and explain how the disability relates to what they're asking for.
Now, in your answer, you mentioned also the term reasonable accommodation in addition to the term reasonable modification. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk. What is a reasonable accommodation?
An accommodation is a change in rules, policies, or procedures that would allow a person with a disability, again, to enjoy the same rights that someone without a disability might have. That may be a change in, let's give an example. If the landlord says rent payments must be paid in person at the rental office on the first of every month, someone with a mobility impairment that would be very difficult for, they may have an accommodation to be able to send their rent payment in by check. Again, if it's on the first of the month, the person may not get their Social Security check until the third of the month, and they may have an accommodation to pay by the fourth or fifth rather than the first. So it's a change in a rule or a policy.
So how is a tenant supposed to request a reasonable modification? I mean, does the landlord have any burden to let the tenant know that reasonable accommodations are available if the person is disabled? How does all that work?
A landlord generally will have some statement on the application or on the lease agreement that explains to the tenant how they would prefer to get those recommendations. But there is no legal requirement that any sort of, you know, it has to be done in some sort of magic form and in some, you know, a specific way. A tenant can ask for a modification or an accommodation at any time, before they're agreeing to rent, after they become renters, and even if they've received an eviction notice and they know that an accommodation would help them not be evicted. And they can do that orally. As an attorney, I always recommend that people do it in writing. The landlord may have a form that they'd prefer that they'd use. That's certainly a good way to do it, because that way you know that you're giving the landlord the information that he needs.
Now, but if I understand your answer correctly, the law does not impose upon the landlord an affirmative obligation to tell the tenant that if you are in fact disabled and you need an accommodation to enjoy the benefits of this housing, you can ask for it. Is that a correct statement?
He doesn't have to tell the tenant that. And in fact, if he does tell the tenant that, he should tell every tenant that. A person with a disability should not be treated any differently. So when the person is choosing to rent an apartment, say, the landlord should not specifically mention their disability or ask them questions about their disability or their ability to live independently or anything like that. If he wants to make a statement about accommodations and modifications are available, that really should be made to all people. Because remember, not all disability is visible.
So it's sort of like a two-edged sword for the landlord. I mean, it can't really ask about disability during the application process, but at the same time, if a reasonable accommodation would be needed for someone if they did have a disability, then the landlord would not only have to mention to that person, but pretty much to everybody.
Yes, and the responsibility falls on the individual with a disability who needs the modification or accommodation to request that. It's not up to the landlord to figure out what the individual needs. The individual is the expert on what they need.
So how is a person with a disability even to know that if they have a disability and if they need an accommodation, that they have a right to it and they need to ask for it?
You know, that's an issue that we at DLCV deal with, is educating the public on what their rights are. And there are wonderful organizations out there that do the same thing. Housing Opportunities Made Equal, the Fair Housing Office here in Virginia. Everybody's trying to get the word out about what people's rights are.
So we're talking about reasonable accommodations, and this is probably another it depends answer, but in general, what is considered reasonable in terms of a reasonable accommodation?
Reasonable has two prongs, and one is the one we've already talked about, the financial burden. You know, is the person asking for something that is, you know, would be an undue financial burden for the landlord? And we're talking here a lot about landlords, but remember, this does apply to, you know, other organizations other than just rental properties. But the second prong to the reasonableness is it related to the person's disability? So something may be a reasonable accommodation for one person, but not for another. If I have a mobility impairment and I need a parking space close to my unit so that I don't have to walk so far, I can ask for an assigned parking space even though everybody else doesn't have one. Now, if I had a mental illness and I asked for a parking space close to my apartment and it wasn't related to my disability at all, that wouldn't be reasonable.
Now, earlier you mentioned a tenant can ask for a reasonable accommodation, even if they get an eviction notice, a notice to terminate their tenancy because of perhaps something that they did, some behavior of theirs or something of that nature. I know that in the employment law, to get a reasonable accommodation, you have to show that you're otherwise a BFOQ, bona fide occupational qualifications. Is there a similar thing for tenants, that you otherwise have to show that you're otherwise an acceptable qualified tenant?
Absolutely. People with disabilities still have to follow the lease requirements. So if they are threatening danger to themselves or others, they can be evicted for that. They can still ask for an accommodation, but they can still be evicted for that. They still have to pay the rent, and they have to pay it on time. They have to keep up any sort of requirements for the apartment itself in good repair and whatnot. So, when someone asks for an accommodation, it has to be related to their disability.
Well, what if the behavior that the landlord wants to evict for is linked to the disability, in particular a mental illness that would cause a person difficulty in controlling what they say and what they do? How is that supposed to work out between the landlord and the tenant? Is there a limit to what accommodation the landlord has to give in that situation?
The tenant can ask the landlord for an accommodation. In that situation, the tenant may say, I'm going to attend an anger management class. Can we hold off this eviction until I complete that? And then if, this behavior happens again, we'll revisit that. So that would be an accommodation that someone could ask for.
And just as we discussed who would pay for a reasonable modification, and the answer was, it depends on whether it's private or federally subsidized housing. If there's any cost to a reasonable accommodation, who pays for that?
Generally, it would be the landlord if it's a change in a rule or a policy. In the situation that I just mentioned, the landlord would not be required to pay for that anger management class. But if they're changing a rule or a policy, then the landlord pays for that. There usually isn't any cost really associated with, although I will go back to that, the parking space issue. So if the individual asks for a parking space, that's an accommodation because the rule is nobody gets assigned parking. They're asking for an accommodation of, I need assigned parking. The landlord would then pay to have that a sign put up that it's assigned parking.
What type of verification would be required from a tenant who is asking for a reasonable accommodation?
It's a very similar answer. Just enough verification to show that they have a disability, that they qualify as a person with a disability under the Fair Housing Act, and that the accommodation that they're requesting is related to that disability.
So again, the Social Security award letter or case manager note or doctor note if necessary.
If your landlord requests your full medical record, you have a problem. That is not required.
And final question is, where can people get more information about the rights of persons with disabilities to fair housing?
Well, I mentioned two wonderful organizations here in Virginia. One is Housing Opportunities Made Equal, or sometimes you'll hear it called HOME. And the other is we have a fair housing office here in Virginia, the Virginia Fair Housing Office. We are certainly a resource here at the Disability Law Center of Virginia. We don't take fair housing cases right now, but anyone who calls can get information and referral about these things that we've been talking about today.
And what would be the website for the Disability Law Center of Virginia in case someone wants additional information?
Okay. That's www.dlcv.org.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Dana Tranum. She is a senior staff attorney at the Disability Law Center of Virginia, and we have been talking about the rights of persons with disabilities to fair housing and to not face discrimination based upon their disability. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Marty.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 800-200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. You can get free legal information at the statewide legal aid website. This is www.valegalaid.org. You also may get free pre-recorded legal information by phone during non-business hours. These are before 9 a.m., after 5 p.m., and on weekends and legal holidays. Call toll-free 1-866-534-5243. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Virginia is an employment at will state, but state and local government employees have rights which private sector employees lack. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when employment law attorney Mark Barron explains how he saves the careers of government employees through the effective use of grievance procedures. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.